39 and a public hearing on 3338. And with this, we will open a work session on Senate Bill 583. And we just lost our quorum.
Stick a phone call.
Yeah. And we will stand at ease for a moment. Chair would entertain a motion on Senate Bill 583 to adopt the A9 amendments.
Mr. Chair, I would be happy to offer that amendment if there maybe it would happen while I was out in the hall, but I believe the A9s are an LFO technical fix.
That's correct.
And that's all they do, and these are agreed upon and LFO technical only.
Yes, I just talked to the chair of the committee, and he is aware that these are being added so that they can get the positions.
Great. Well, then I would be prepared to move the A9 amendments to Senate Bill 583.
Okay. Senator Johnson moves the -9 amendments to Senate Bill 583. Is there any discussion? Those are the technical amendments, which are simply necessary, and basically the reason that the bill arrived in Ways and Means, and therefore in front of our committee. Seeing no discussion, is there any objections? Seeing none, noting that Senator Bates and Representative Blasio are excused. Senate Bill 583 is amended, and then we would have a motion to move the Senate Bill 583 to the Full Ways and Means Committee as amended, with a due pass recommendation.
Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 583 as amended to the full Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Johnson moves Senate Bill 583 as amended to the full Committee on Ways and Means as amended, with a due pass recommendation. Is there any objections?
Not objection. I just wanted to put on the record that I am concerned about the word harm in that bill, and I think that the word harm really should be identified, defined. I've talked to the chief sponsor about that. It is, I'm really concerned that it opens the door for non-economic damages, and I could see a horrendous class action situation there. I'm not being a lawyer, maybe that's over the top, but that is my concern. I will support the bill, but I would certainly like to see it subsequently amended to define.
Thank you, Senator. Appreciate those comments and that observation, and hopefully in rules or somewhere they can, and maybe they'll want to come back and visit that in February or some subsequent. Any other discussion? Seeing none, any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Again, noting that Senator Bates and Representative Blasio are excused.
Mr. Chair, just by way of information, Senator Bates called me and indicated that he was making good time coming up from his district, and he's anticipated here shortly. I know that he has a keen interest in the next bill on the agenda, and I didn't know whether or not you would be amenable to adjusting the agenda to make sure he could fully participate.
I would be happy to accommodate the good senator in that particular regard. With that, we will close our work session on Senate Bill 583, obviously, and we will open a public hearing. Representative,
thank you.
Get away from me. When she was here, we will be back later on House Bill 3099. Staff, would you please call
Representative? And there she is.
Oh, thank you. As we speak.
I thought she was going to switch that.
We are opening a public hearing on House Bill 3338, and I see the representative here to talk to us about that bill. If you would, please, Betty.
Thank you. Can I have Jill Kirk join me also?
Thank you.
That's fine. Please.
Thank you.
Do you want to be in the
right there?
Good morning, Chair Jensen. For the record, my name is Representative Betty Comp, and I represent House District 22, which is Woodburn, Jervis, Brooks, and parts of North Salem. And thank you for considering this bill this morning. House Bill 3338 is part of what we're going to ask in the governor's budget and plan for education. This is a bill that would create a design team in order for the legislature to be a major component in saying how can we reach our vision of 100% of all students to graduate from high school, with 40% of those students going on to receive an associate's degree or its equivalent, and then another 40% to get their bachelor's degree. I'm going to ask Jill to give a little bit more of the background. There were nine legislators that worked in a bipartisan, bicameral team last interim to start this process, and this is a continuation of this process. Oregon Business Council has been, they have helped make this process possible. They brought us all together in the same room, and so that we could say, well, what do we see is happening in education, and where do we want it to go? I will be here to answer any questions, but I want to give Jill an opportunity to share Oregon Business Council's perspective and any thoughts that you have. So thank you, Chair.
Thanks.
Good morning, Chair Jensen. My name is Jill Kirk. I'm Vice President of the Oregon Business Council. Very pleased to be here today to speak on behalf of House Bill 3338. As Representative Comp said, last summer the Oregon Business Council was approached by a small group of legislators, bicameral and bipartisan, who were interested in learning more about the education initiative that the Business Council had been working on, which involves four major pieces. One of them is a vision for education for Oregonians attaining a higher level of education and a higher quality of education, which will benefit everyone individually and collectively. And to support that, three structural changes. One of them creating a very continuous curriculum and set of assessments that will allow students to move through the process much more easily than they are able to at the moment. A data system, which is being supported and worked on heavily now with your support, and a revision of the entire budget process so that you all, as legislators who make policy and who are responsible for funding the public education system and really understanding how it is performing, would have better information with which to guide your decisions. So what we have been looking at is really a student-centered, performance-based budget process that's quite different from the one which is in use now and which has just evolved over a long period of time. And it is increasingly the case that as we show what it is that you could know and what kinds of questions you could ask and the kinds of decisions you could make with a different budget system, that is very attractive to a number of legislators and also to the governor's office, who is very supportive of this endeavor as well. So what this bill does is allow you to really set aside thought and time to reexamine your own legislative processes around setting education budgets and performance standards and expectations for the system. As Representative Comp said, There's been a lot of work done already, but there's a great deal more to do. And it is work that the Oregon Business Council will be happy to continue to help support. But we think that we have reached a point where our work is now really secondary to your own.
Just to follow up, Chair Jensen, this process has been really in, it began much earlier than what we have stated so far. James Zager is here from the governor's office, but this really started in the summer of 2004, looking at some of this research, and has grown and blossomed. I like to give the metaphor of a planting a seed, and now it's starting to grow and bloom. But James is here to answer any questions, but the thing that is the most, I think is the most important, is where we're going to look at a student growth model, and that is to monitor how students' academic growth is occurring over the years. Currently, the state is in complete compliance with the No Child Left Behind Act, but that act only is looking at one test score in states that are getting this system in place to show growth every year have been given an okay by the federal government to do an alternative method of complying to that those federal laws. And so if we have this system in place, then we will be able to truly show what our students are learning every day in the classroom, just not by one test. And with that, if you have any questions, and as I say, there's a representative from the governor's office here to help us with any other questions.
Senator Whitson.
Thank you, Chair Jensen. Representative, I have a couple of questions. I think it's a very laudable effort here. One of the, my concerns is that the way the it's structured, you could very well have a 9-2 representation of the majority party on this board. On this group, and that seems inequitable.
I did not interpret it as that, but if that's your interpretation, I believe that that could be. The reality, what we did last time in the interim was to have it bicameral, bipartisan. It was very balanced. There was a three of each, and yes, it was complete imbalance.
Follow up, Senator.
Yes, I understood that in your testimony, but
that's not what it says.
The bill.
Okay.
And the second question that I have is about the goals of all students to graduate from high school. 40% would get their Associate of Arts and 40% would get a BS. I don't believe that we would ever set up a series of key performance measures with that high a hurdle. The likelihood of ever getting anyone, you know, any school to graduate 100% of their students and having 80% of them get a higher education degree doesn't seem possible.
Thank you, Senator Whitsitt, Chair Jensen. We talked a long time about whether we should set a timeline for some performance measures in between incrementally. And yet, I believe this was, we'd have to go back and look at our notes, but something we did have full consensus on, and we fully acknowledge that is an incredibly high bar to reach or a high outcome. But if we don't set it there, who are we willing to say can't make it? And that's how we came to that point.
Senator Johnson.
Mr. Chair, I apologize for popping in and out. I may have to do it again. So if this question's been asked, just tell me and I'll go away.
I'd never want that to happen.
I fully support the idea that there be some legislative engagement. But given the heavy emphasis on the recruitment of some extraordinarily capable Oregonians for the State Board of Higher Education and the State Board of Education, how does this process not second-guess the work of those boards and undermine the work of those boards, complicate the work of those boards? What if we come to different conclusions?
I'm going to ask James to pull a chair up, and because I believe this will complement, not complicate, but he can give a better response than I can.
Thank you.
Thank you. For the record, James Sager, Governor's Office. That's a very good question, Senator Johnson, Chair Jensen. I don't know what documents have been handed out. I have some that I can give you if you'd like, but the documents that are available here give kind of a chronology of the work that we've been doing over the last 3 years. And so the way this bill is envisioned is that, and let me back up a minute, we were prepared going into this legislative session to present to the legislature a comprehensive picture of education, pre-K through adult education. And this was in collaboration, both boards, the Oregon Workforce Investment Board, and other partners that have been working on this. The difficulty was that except for about a 15-minute presentation that we were able to give to Representative Galizio's committee, there's no process in which we can bring this forward so that the Ways and Means Committees, the substantive education committees, can hear this presentation at the beginning so you get the full picture. And then when you start talking about policies and budgets, it's all disconnected. What we did is we developed a process where we feel very strongly that the budget proposal was driving the policies that were being presented. So what we're looking for is a way that, with your help, we can complement the work, as Representative Comp said, complement the work of the joint boards as they come forward with all their studies and work and say, here are the policies and the budgets that will drive those policies that we believe would be best for Oregon, and then we have a basis to have a dialogue with you.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
About a million years ago, there was a board in Oregon that was the coordinating commission with the idea, and I may get a little spotty on my history about this, but the coordinating commission's job was to try to coordinate the work of the State Board of Higher Education, the State Board of Education, and it was abolished, I think, during the Goldschmidt administration. But what I'm wondering, sort of with you, wondering out loud, is whether or not when you've got all of these independent initiatives, you've got the quality education, you've got boards with citizen advisors, comprised of citizen advisors, at both higher education level, grade school level, community college level, who coordinates the coordinators? Other than one person in the governor's office. I'm just trying to figure out where does, other than making presentations to the legislature, is there a forum that could be the synthesis of all of this data? And I worry that we're going to have a whole bunch of parallel tracks all producing very good information, all requesting the volunteer service of thoughtful Oregonians, all trying to do the best thing, but I don't know where the synthesis occurs.
Chair Jensen, Senator Johnson, that again, very good question. And the way it has operated right now is the governor was very clear with both boards of education that in statute we have what's called the joint boards. And historically, the joint boards would meet maybe once a year and have a nice social, and that was about it. The governor viewed that coordination of those two boards as being kind of the pivot point of all this conversation. So as we move through this process the last 3 years, whether it was around budget alignment, whether it was responding to directives from the legislature, et cetera, we went through the joint boards and had them use the resources of the Quality Education Commission, use the resources of the provosts and the faculty senates and those to bring them together so that they were the focal point of pulling this data together, and they were responsible for that kind of coordination.
Chair Jensen, Representative Johnson, Senator Johnson, if I could add to that, I think that the condition that you've described actually describes the current state of affairs, where you've got a number of commissions and boards all trying to make very good judgments with public funding in this important arena, but with no ability really to level their decisions against any kind of a standard. Each of the three education sectors is budgeted very differently, has very different expectations and performance standards, and so it is really quite difficult for you all to think about how you move students from the very early part of that structure all the way through to the end. if you had a budget that was consistent across those sectors and you were looking at per student costs and performance, then I think you would be able to pull the sectors into complementarity much more effectively than is possible now.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Can I, Chair Jensen, could I follow up just another piece on Senator Johnson's question?
Of course.
Okay, thank you. My comment would be is what we, as Jill has said, when we're talking in this discussion, we have silos of educational institutions. And our budgeting process or our policy process does not follow a nice smooth continuum. We would like to say that the first grade class of 2008, that it's what Senator Whitsitt was referring to. How are we going to monitor that class all the way till they're 22 years old? We have no mechanism, no system that will do the longitudinal piece. And so that is what we would be talking about. Well, how could we? And then we'd bring those suggestions back to the legislature.
Follow up.
Now that's caused me to have one more question.
Okay.
We have in this building in prior biennia spent money on computer systems that are supposed to be doing this. I understand from my reading of this bill that this is a more structural policy-oriented rather than the mechanical, but I certainly think that you can't have the policy conversation without some touchback to the mechanisms that when you start as a first grader and begin to compile your folder, that somehow that data needs to flow smoothly between your grade school years, your high school years, your community college, but separate for me the mechanics of tracing a student through the system versus the philosophy of designing an educational system that makes that passage effective and accountable.
Senator Johnson, I wish you'd been part of the meeting we had yesterday afternoon. One of the joint board's committees, which is the UEE, which stands for Unified Education Enterprise, that is exactly the conversation that we are discussing, and we had representatives from all the sectors that participate on this board, and that is how do we really bring value to the high school diploma, the new high school graduation requirements. Why is it that, for instance, the universities and community colleges don't ask for the data that we've been collecting? And if they did, what would that mean, and how would that be formed? So within the education community, we have very strong commitment from all the sectors to do the alignment work that is necessary, curriculum alignment, data alignment, et cetera. What doesn't exist right at the moment, or what is a challenge to, I think, all of us, is that when we get into the legislative process and we begin to try to align budgets with these performances we want and with this alignment we want, because no one receives kind of the big overview picture of how this entire continuum is going to operate, in this building we do kind of fall back into these silos. And so all the work that has gone on in the interim to make this alignment, we have to kind of repackage it again and say, well, within community colleges it means this, and then try to reference to something else. What I guess the vision that Representative Comp and other of your fellow legislators and I have had in conversations has been, like I said, having a process whereby during this effort for this bill, we put together a process that the education community knows what you're looking for, can come forward with the data and the information, the alignment work, et cetera, that you need to see that, in fact, the budget proposals are aligned with the goals that we have as a state. And then, like I said, we can have a conversation. If there's something missing, or you think that, well, priority two should really be priority one, then you can have that conversation and know how each of those changes affects each of the sectors of education, rather than wondering, gosh, the budget we just passed out for community colleges, does that positively or negatively impact the universities and the K-12 system? And we just don't have that kind of we don't have the ability to have that kind of really comprehensive conversation today. So that's what we hope this will help bring together.
There's a piece. I'm sorry.
We commissioned Nancy Heiligman, has been working for about the past 6 months, and those of you that don't know Nancy, she's worked for the Department of Ed, and now she works for university system, but she has done a great deal of work over the last 6 months pulling together, again, the data on budgeting so that, in fact, we now have a foundation upon which to, in the interim, have the conversations as to what kinds of structural changes might it take, could it take, would it look like, so that, again, we can have the kinds of conversations we need to have during interim time so that going into the next legislative session, we can actually take action on it.
Thank you.
Representative Galizio.
Good morning. Thanks for all the work. Just play devil's advocate a little bit. I get nervous when I, when you say, you know, what are we looking for in terms of the education enterprise? I don't know that the 90 members of this body are experts in education at all. And it makes me nervous as someone in a classroom to think that they're holding up some kind of bar and saying, or, you know, saying, jump, jump. And I understand the structural alignment so that, if, for example, a community college student can do 2 years and make sure they can transfer smoothly. But when you start talking about kind of getting into curriculum and, you know, this sort of rigid business model and inputs and outputs, I don't know. That makes me extraordinarily uncomfortable. And I do think there's, I mean, we have silos, and I think for a reason. Higher education is wholly different from what happens in K through 12. And I want a PhD in microbiology to be making the decisions, and I don't know that we know what the hell that person should be doing in a classroom. And so, to the extent that it's a, there's this sort of business model of, you know, student goes in system and then comes out in a way that we believe they should come out, it scares the hell out of me. So can you maybe allay my fears?
Representative Aguizzo and Chair Jensen, the system that we're looking at is, to say the least, visionary. We, with the Oregon Business Council and several other contributors, we had several day-long sessions with national and worldwide experts. We fully acknowledge that we are not experts in education. The other component of that, and I'll come back to that, but the State Department of Education has been working since 1990 when we started the 21st Century Education Act on doing standards and student outcome expectations for all K-12 students. That system has been worked, reworked, and is really in a top-notch form at this time. We would not be talking about what is the curriculum standard for social studies in fourth grade. What we would be looking at is how do students that are ready for college classes or to get into a community college at 10th or 11th grade, how do they do that in the system? And where does that money go? Where does it start and where does it follow? So we're not talking about actual curriculum, day-to-day teaching standards. We're talking about if we're going to have 40% of all students receive a bachelor's degree, what's the system that would support them? And so we're certainly not curriculum experts by any means.
Follow up, yeah. But this body is just like the I would argue that in this country, in this culture, we have this sort of testing mania. Okay, the standardization of education, which some people really like, and it's all about accountability. But some of us think that you're creating as many problems and you're hindering education as much as you're ostensibly helping. And so I worry that this performance measure based, you know, student A should be able to do X, Y, and Z, and a bunch of people here who, you know, well-intentioned but maybe know not very much about education, and it's already happening in the status quo. So I don't know if, just the way you describe it, and it's kind of slippery. I think we could save a lot of money. Better fund education in Oregon. Train teachers and provide them the tools and the resources that are necessary. Actually have investment in capital, and I mean, it's not just about money, but these people are professionals, and they're treated like they're, you know, frontline. I don't want to disparage anybody, but just, I mean, these are people who ostensibly are professionals in their job, and we're going in and we're going to say, oh yeah, we're the big experts. We know what you should be doing. We know what outcomes you should have. It seems.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll just make a couple of quick comments and ask a question. I just completed the midnight ride of Paul Revere because I saw some things posted at 4 o'clock yesterday afternoon. I spent yesterday, a delightful day, watching 150 fifth graders graduating to the sixth grade and watching the teachers bring them up. And from that, I'm going to make a few comments and ask a question, okay? School board, 10 years, watching kids go through schools for 25 years, watching SIMS and CAMS come in, watching SIMS and CAMS go out, quality education model come in, everyone wonder how you're going to pay for it, chalkboard project going on and off. Department of Education, yeah, they're great. No, they don't, can't do a darn thing. Remember the old RAND report and how they got slammed by that. Governor's Commission on Quality Education back in the early 90s were always out there reforming the schools. When I look down through who's going to be on this committee, I think back to whenever I saw those reforms come through, and I go down and talk to my teachers, and my teacher would just roll their eyes. They say, well, just wait till this one goes away and the next one comes, and we'll put up with as much as we have to, but they'll roll their eyes. And thank God they do that. Because in the end, they're the ones that educate our kids and do a great job despite what we do to them up here, despite what the Department of Education does to them, despite what SIMS and CAMS did to them, despite what QEM did to them, despite what the Chalkboard Project is trying to do to them, and despite what we're trying to do to them today, they get the job done. I saw it yesterday. So I'll vote for this thing because it's going to sunset in a year and a half. And it might have some value to bring back some information to the legislature. But I bet if I lined up 60 teachers behind you right now, they'd be rolling their eyes. Because it's the same old, we're going to reform education again. Now, maybe this time you've got something that really will help us understand the system better. But I'm just putting in a little bit of caution here, a little thoughtfulness. And that's just the ones I can think off the top of my head we put onto teachers, onto their backs. Not let them do the job they need to do and the job they do despite us. We don't fund them, we don't take care of them, and we just lay things on them all the time. So I'll vote for this. We'll get it out, and we'll see what comes back in the report. I hope something good comes out of this one. But I have a little bit of, how can I put this? I'll say caution about it. Representative Crumble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We saw this bill.
I forgot to ask my question.
I also.
Would you wait? Thank you. Please. Mr. Chair, the question is, you've got a bunch of people on this thing. You've got, as usual, two teachers. I would really feel good about this if the majority of people on this design team were teachers who are teaching, people down the trenches, not superintendents. You know, not members of education departments, but the people who are actually teaching. If they were designing this thing, I might have some confidence something good would actually come out of it, and not just two of them. Right. I mean voting members. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Crummell.
Absolutely, Senator. You were great last night's show, by the way. We saw this bill in education. I was also sitting on the substantive education committee, and the issue that Senator Witzer brought up with regards to performance standards, particularly with on line 25 where it says all students graduate from high school. A lot of our reforms in education end up being because of the 7% or so that tend to have a real difficult time getting through the system. But I just will echo Senator Witzer's question about that. But what, with regards to the data systems and following up a little bit on Senator Johnson's comments with regards to the data systems, we passed the K-12 budget. We also passed the school improvement fund, and then there was another bill at the department's fund. Within those three budgets was the funding for, I know the acronym is KIDS too. I can't remember what K and I stand for, but I know DNS is data systems. And one of the things that was frustrating during the last interim in talking with the department is that many times in terms of further development of the system, of the data system, they were talking about FERPA being the Federal Education Records Protection Act. They were talking about FERPA kind of standing in the way and not allowing them to get all of this data. But that's one of the things that that is supposed to do, is to help us track a student from the time that they enter in kindergarten or earlier until they graduate from high school, and then being able to pass that information on to the university system. Is this design team going to be able to get over that, get through that, get and help the department get around that so that FERPA is not the excuse? Because we're putting many millions of dollars into that into that data system, and I'm more concerned about performance of that than I am performance of this. I think the other goals are a lot of 40%, but I do think that all systems are for failure.
Chair Jensen, Representative Crummell, yes, the department is working through that, and they've been working very closely with both DOJ and the U.S. Department of Education to make sure that we don't have FERPA violations. And part of it had to do with how you allow, if a student transfers, say, from one school to another, how you allow that data to follow the student, because the school that the student is exiting cannot just arbitrarily say, oh, yeah, we're going to send it on. There has to be a request by the guardian. So they're working on all that. But if I could, for a moment, Senator Jensen, if I could go back to a couple of the other two questions, because I think there's some confusion here today. The original bill, the original 3338, dealt with a commission or a new group of folks coming together looking at revamping education or reforming education. The new version, the version that the amended, the B engrossed, I guess, version, or A engrossed version, the reform is here inside the legislature. In other words, what we're looking at is being able to allow educators in the education community who have been doing a lot of work, as I indicate, over the last 3 years, to be able to come forward and say, looking at the needs of Oregon students, young and old, the Oregon workforce, the economy, here are the kinds of things that we believe we need in place, whether it's expanding our ability to train nurses or train electricians or train philosophers. Here's what Oregon needs in the education system in order to be able to meet the needs of the state, the students, et cetera. And so having the education community be able to come to the legislature, and that the legislature be designed, the process be designed in such a manner in which you can receive the total presentation at one time. And so the engrossed version looks simply at the legislature, a team of legislators coming together, working with the governor's office on talking about how we redesign that process. And I believe that part of the reason that the governor's office is engaged in that is because we're also engaged in pulling the education community together. So we want to make sure that the education community work is going, and the way that they're going to be able to present this material is going to meet your needs. And so the bills, you might be confusing bills.
We're going to cease this dissertation on this bill. The chair wants to has some other agendas to take care of this morning, and I want to hear from two or three other groups, and I'm going to take about 2 minutes to do that, and that's 2 minutes for all the other groups, not for that. And I'd like to hear from OSBA, COSA, and the unions. And I don't, is OEA here? Is OSCA here? Okay.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. AFT, any of those. And basically, I want to know, without
you know, lengthy discussion. Do you support? Do you like? Are you neutral, or do you dislike?
Mr. Chairman, Chuck Bennett with the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. Mr. Chairman, just the questions being asked are absolutely on the mark. They're the kinds of questions we're asking. We believe the questions being asked and issues being raised will be part of the process through this entire discussion really into the past with the whole discussion of P20 through the design team analysis and development. We will be asking those questions throughout. With that in mind, we have been supportive of this approach. This has been the direction education has been taking at this point, so we currently support this. We'll be back if we see this falling apart, and I think Senator Bates' invocation of SimCam and some of the other things we've been through points to the fundamental concern that we all have.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, one tiny question.
That'll take 8 seconds?
No more than 8 seconds.
Okay,
Mr. Chair. I note that there is no vocational track in this entire bill. Would you comment on that, Mr. Bennett?
Mr. Chairman,
6 seconds.
We noted that, too, and we'll be noting that throughout the discussion as this is developed.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, David Williams with the Oregon School Boards Association. Just to second everything Mr. Bennett said on behalf of COSA, OSBA as well has concerns, but is eagerly anticipating the discussions about P20 system. We've been talking about it for quite a few years now without any sort of formal structure, and I think that this provides that formal structure to take that conversation forward to answer a lot of these questions and really clarify the direction the state wants to go.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association. And first, let me say that we appreciate the questions and concerns of the committee about the continuing should we do it better, could we do it better, look at education. On the other hand, we understand and support the concept that education should be a whole life experience and our systems should be cooperative and complementary. And P20 is the way to get us there. And so we support this design team. We support the efforts that are behind it, and we will be sitting there watching and coming back to you with any concerns we have, because what our hope is with this process is that our education systems, which are now competing, will start being cooperative and helpful to the legislature and understanding.
Thank you. Thank you very much, and I appreciate your input. Let me conclude by saying that I share many of the concerns with members of the committee, with Senator Bates and Representative Galizio. I think their concerns are very well taken. With maybe one exception, I've been around this business of education now for a good deal longer than perhaps the combined total of some of the rest of the members of the committee, and I quite frankly have seen these things come and go and roll our eyes at them for a long time, and in fact you can trace the history of much of what goes on in education by tracing this through the presidencies of this country. Every time a new president and administration comes along, they've got some grandiose idea how to improve schools and how to improve education. We continually look to a variety of sources and say we're falling behind, and perhaps we are. And maybe the reason we're falling behind is because we spend too much time trying to reinvent education instead of going back just looking at the fact that the people that we have, A, in the classrooms, and B, in the administration, are people who are professionals. I'm reminded of Dale Parnell's words again, and I can't quote them just exactly, but You know, and that's archaic now because the times have changed since then. But his words were something like, you know, school boards don't teach, AB doesn't teach, et cetera, et cetera. Teachers teach. And maybe we ought to keep that in mind, give the resources and that sort of thing that are necessary for teachers to teach and get out of the way and let them teach. But so much from my particular biases on it. And with that, we're going to exercise the power of the gavel and close the public hearing on that and open our work session on House Bill 3099. Thank you. The staff is here to help us a little get started with that. John, can you enlighten us a little on 3099? And this is a public hearing, you'll understand. Not a public hearing, but a work session. I believe it's literally open. And with that, testimony is invited testimony, although if somebody has some burning issues, I'll be happy to consider that. Please go ahead, John. Okay.
Good morning, Chair and members of the committee. Before you is HB 3099A, relating to safe drinking water. The measure came out of the House Health Care Committee. They had three meetings, one subcommittee meeting and two full committee meetings. It was reported out without recommendation to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Before you are several documents. The first is a staff measure summary from that substantive committee. The second is a preliminary staff measure summary from the Legislative Fiscal Office. And the third is a fiscal impact on the A and gross version. The measure does not have a revenue impact, and the measure requires that on the A and gross version that water suppliers serving more than 10,000 persons add fluoride to drinking water in amounts and manner prescribed by DHS. DHS may temporarily exempt a water supplier serving more than 10,000 persons from this requirement until the department determines that the water supplier has sufficient funds to purchase fluoridation equipment from a source other than fees, taxes, or charges by the water supplier to the water supplier's ratepayers, shareholders, local taxpayers, or bondholders. Lastly, the measure prohibits cities, counties, and other municipalities from enacting ordinances or provisions that restrict fluoridation of water as outlined in the Act. Speaking specifically from the fiscal impact on the A and gross version, as clarification, DHS states that temporary exemption means that water systems serving more than 10,000 persons are exempt from the mandate until appropriate funding to purchase community water fluoridation treatment equipment is identified and secured. DHS would use administrative rule process to outline the exemption requirements. Furthermore, DHS states that there are currently no funds identified or available to fund this measure, including state general fund or other or federal funds contained within the department's budget. The department notes that other states have enacted similar legislation, and they use federal grant funds from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Fiscal Office further notes that the measure does not prohibit use of non-water supplier funds taxes to fund the purchase, including state general fund or federal taxes. Before this subcommittee as well, Chair and members of the committee, is a -5 amendment that was provided to the Legislative Fiscal Office before the subcommittee meeting. In essence, Section 4 of the -5 amendment provides a procedure for local governments to refer a measure to their specific jurisdictions for an ordinance to decline to fluoridate their water. The measure would have that rejection of the proposed ordinance, then the local government shall comply with fluoridation. Section 5 of the measure of the -5 amendment would provide that once Section 4 is eliminated, then the results of that election would remain in statute or would remain noted. as to those communities who declined to fluoridate. Section 6 states that if a water supplier that fluoridates their water supplies a non-fluoridated water supply district, that water supply district that is receiving that fluoridated water cannot charge their ratepayers a different rate for the fluoridated water. And with that, Chair Jensen, it's the measure.
Thank you. And I have Representative Greenlee here, who's chief sponsor of the measure.
That one section
Would you mind coming up, Representative Greenlee? You're bringing with you. Thank you, pardon, Representative. Got to bring your brains with you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee. I'm here to urge you to adopt the Dash 5 amendments to House Bill 3099 and then adopt 3099 and send it up the chain so we can get it back to the House for a floor vote. I've been a public health professional perhaps as long as you, Mr. Chair, have been a teacher, almost as long, a teacher during that time, and this has been an issue that that I've observed as a scientist all the while. It really is time for Oregon to join with the other 46 states, I think it is, that fluoridate the water supply and establish this as the policy of the state. In the political context, getting it this far to you, we have folks who believe strongly in fluoridating water. We have folks that oppose 3099 on the basis of the underlying concepts of fluoridation, their concerns about safety and science. And then we had folks who were concerned about the 3099 in its engross form, because it didn't allow communities to have their own say on whether or not the communities wanted fluoride in the water. The Dash 5 amendments address this greater concern. I know folks from Southern Oregon come from communities that have rejected fluoride on a number of occasions. I've heard from the city of Portland that they have some interest in rejecting fluoride, and that seems to me to be a reasonable approach. I really do think local option makes a lot of sense. So I think Dash 5 are important amendments because it gives a specific route by which a community in either the 08 primary election or the 08 general election can refer this matter to their voters to see whether the citizens of their community want fluoride in their water or not. And the prediction is some will, some won't, but I think it's a proper thing to do. So I'd be very happy to answer any questions that came up in the discussions. We, as you heard, had three hearings, one in Representative Kotek's subcommittee, two in the full committee. We had tons of testimony on all 360 degrees of opinion around the bill.
Please, Representative.
Just for the record, Representative Kotek, Tina Kotek, State Representative, House District 44. I think Representative Greenlee has covered everything, and we're happy to answer questions.
Thank you. Representative Galizia.
Good morning. On the Dash 5 amendment, children don't get to vote. So isn't that problematic? Why should, I mean, 2007, where, you know, I understand there are heartfelt beliefs in opposition to, I happen to think, from the science that I read, that it's probably, I don't know, I go with the Dental Association and what I would say is the legitimate science, and I know there are huge disagreements, but why should I adopt the Dash 5 when it's children, through no fault of their own, might be suffering because the adults are going to make a decision that might not be in the best interest of the public health of those kids.
Well, there are, I think, two issues raised by your question. Mr. Chair, Representative Luizio. One issue is the public health model, I think, it raises. There, it became clear that in our discussions that there was almost a class issue involved in this. Middle-class kids may not need fluoride in the water. The parents are prepared. They buy fluoride toothpaste. They take the kids to the dentist to get them fluoridated. We used to have fluoride tablets that the kids took. I mean, our kids had lots of fluoride, although they were raised the first 5 years of their life in a fluoridated water system in Ann Arbor, and that was very, they all have great teeth, I think, because of that. But poor kids don't have that opportunity, and we had testimony after testimony of poor kids showing up in the dental office for the first time or in a doctor's office because of dental problems with mouths in terrible shape that took a lot of problems. And from a public health perspective, it seems clear that if we're going to deal with the health of those kids, we have to do it in a community way rather than an individual way. It won't be, as one of our members said, well, why don't we just spend the money and buy a bunch of toothpaste for the poor kids? I mean, that was not a serious question, actually, but it really does frame the issue in a way that's important. You can buy that toothpaste, but it's not going to get it in their mouth. But the other question you raise is the question of should kids vote? And I don't think we're prepared yet to have to drop the voting age to 4 or something to do that. And typically, parents vote for their kids. The problem here, having raised the public health model, is the parents really, in this case, aren't necessarily voting for their kids, for or against their kids. They're voting about something that's affecting some other kids. And that takes a kind of a community altruism that I think we will have in many communities, but we may not have in others. But they are the voters, and we probably, I haven't noticed an amendment that changes the voting age in this one.
Chair Jensen, and thank you, Chair Jensen, Representative Galizio. I just want to add to that and say, I'm not as very thrilled about the A5s, but I think it's a response to what we heard about local control, and we want to give an option for communities who can make that decision. And we've tried to set out the process so we could simplify it for every community, and I think we should do it right away, but I'm willing to give folks a year to opt out.
Senator Bate.
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, it's always nice to see a co-chair here when he shows up, because I know he misses my company, so I know he came down just to see me today. Having said that, it's pretty obvious that the vote in this committee is preordained by moving members around, which tells you you've got a problem. You've got a big problem here, okay? And I'll try not to be too cranky because I get up at 4 a.m. to drive up here because this thing was posted at 4 o'clock yesterday afternoon, which also indicates to me you've got a problem. I think you've got a problem with votes on the floor, and the reason you've got a problem with votes on the floor is you're doing the wrong thing. You are doing the wrong thing. A couple of questions I may, Mr. Chair.
If you may.
Has Portland ever voted on whether they want fluoridation in their water or not?
There was a Multnomah County vote many years ago. It was probably 20 or 25 years ago.
Follow-up question. Is there anything that prohibits Portland right now from fluoridating its water?
No.
Follow-up?
Follow-up.
Prohibits Eugene, Medford, or Ashland from fluoridating their water?
No.
They have the right to do this local option right now, is that correct?
They have the right to do that now.
Does it strike you a little arrogant that we're telling them to take a vote on something that they could do themselves if they wanted to?
Yeah.
Chair Jensen, Senator Bates, I appreciate your questions. I've thought about this because people have asked me those questions. Why not just let the local communities decide? For whatever reason, we have decided that we aren't willing at the local level to take on what is a very important public health issue. And I think sometimes the state has to step in. We do it with other public health issues. We have serious oral health issues in this state, not just for our kids, but for our adults and for our seniors. It is the state's responsibility to set public health policy, I believe, for certain issues. We are saying that this is good for the oral health of our state. If we pass this, we are giving local communities an option to not follow that. But I do think as a public health issue, unfortunately, sometimes at the local political level, they need a little push to have this conversation, and that's what this would do. Thank you.
follow-up questions, Mr. Chair?
Follow-up. May I comment on that, too?
Yeah.
Senator Bates. You and I have been on the same side of a lot of issues, and we have, in a lot of those issues, taken state stands on things. We're dealing with one right now with the Indoor Air Act and a variety of other things. We do decide that sometimes there is a state interest that forces us to take some action, and frequently we give local communities the right to opt out, but frequently we don't give local communities the right to opt out. And in a public health way, sometimes we just have to do those things. We say things like kids need to be immunized before they show up in school. That's a pretty arrogant act in a lot of ways, but we decide that at the state level, and we impose that because there are strong public health concerns that make it the right thing to do.
Follow up. The difference here, from my point of view, is that when we do immunizations for kids or we try to cut down smoking, the evidence is clear, and no one argues the evidence that that's the right thing to do. That is not the case of the situation. Question, Mr. Chair?
Follow-up question.
What was the first state that was went to statewide fluoridation, do you know offhand, and when it was done?
I
believe it was Connecticut in 1965. Do you know the results of that have been as far as low-income kids are concerned, as far as ending dental caries or dental disease?
Well, I've seen data in a variety of places that deal with population-based incidents of caries and disease. I think the problem with what's happened in those kind of instances is you're dealing with population medians and means, and you're not dealing with the particular problems of the kids at high risk. I mean, I think the same thing is true of other disease statistics.
I agree. Mr. Chair, follow-up question?
Follow-up.
Western Europe's an area that we consider first-world countries, and they have a much lower rate of dental disease than we do. What percentage of their population is fluoridated?
I don't know the answer to that, but I know they also have a lower rate of heart disease and a lower rate of hypertension, a lower rate of cancer, a lower rate of a lot of things that really relate to cultural issues in their lifestyle and perhaps even genetic issues that affect those things. So I don't think we can. I mean, the fact that we're worse than them on almost all public health measures, my guess is worse than them on dental health, even with fluoridation, shouldn't surprise us.
Chair Jensen and Senator Bates, my understanding in Europe, it differs from country to country. Sometimes their water systems aren't set up in such a way, but they do fluoridated salt. They have fluoridation in other ways. But I have not read any literature to suggest that folks in Europe think fluoridation is necessarily a bad thing. And in terms of the data, I think we've seen some strong data from other states and historical data that says this works. But when I talk to dentists, I just spoke with someone outside the hall who said, I have a relative who's a dentist. They serve here in Marion County, and they serve kids up in Albany. They can see the difference. Salem has fluoridated water. Counties in near vicinity do not, and that dentist can tell the difference. We've heard very striking testimony about that. To me, that kind of night and day difference in who's got fluoridated water is what should drive this conversation.
Chair, we're not going to get into this whole policy debate. They've gone through it before. I could give evidence just the opposite, and I actually don't have any opinion on this one way or the other, but my opinion is we don't know. There's all kinds of studies showing it works. There's studies that shows it doesn't work. There's issues of fluorosis in kids that we don't have time to discuss here. Europe has about a 2% fluoridation rate and much lower dental problem than we do, and the reasons, I believe, we have access to dental care. When I think of a meth mother feeding formula to her kid out of tap water with fluoridated water, which we know we can't use fluoridated water in formula for kids, you think she's going to worry about something like that? We're talking about low-income people who need better health care for their children. And the answer here, I don't believe, is fluoridated water. I think it's better access to dental care. I think we probably all agree to that. We know we have a population related to poverty in this country, mainly in children and in adults that have terrible teeth, that leads to all kinds of disease, not only of the mouth, but the entire body. And it's something we need to deal with. I'm just not convinced fluoridation is the way to do it, folks. I don't think it's going to help at all. I don't think it's going to make any difference. And until I have evidence that says it does, I can't vote for this.
Mr. Chair.
Let me just finish real quickly. I'll stop. And I would push very strongly, as you have with me, for better access to dental care and getting those families educated on how to take care of those kids' mouths. I'm just unconvinced right now, and I'm concerned. I am seriously concerned about potential unknown hazards of fluoridation of water. We've just changed the parts per million from 4 to 1 because it was too high before, and we don't know what the real level is. It's absolutely safe. It's probably reasonably safe. I don't know for sure. So why are we doing this when the real problem is access to dental care? That's where it should be going. But it really doesn't matter this morning. The votes are here to move it out, and I don't want to take any more of your time.
Mr. Chair, I do want to put on the record a comment. I've studied the data on this. There is frankly not a single scientist from a major university who studied this problem over time that has not expressed the opinion that the overwhelming evidence supports the notion that fluoridation is effective in reducing dental health, especially dental health problems, especially in poor kids, and that the data on the safety of fluoridating water, with the exception of the problems of the minor fluoridosis problems that can happen, is the data is overwhelming on the safety of this issue. The people who present evidence against that are essentially not in the mainstream of science. And I agree with Senator Bates. We have to have access to dental care. There's no question about that.
I don't think any of us don't agree with that. Colleagues, I do want to extend an invitation to any one group, if anybody is representing the anti or opposed, here. I would be happy to give you 4 or 5 minutes to make your comments to us. And I don't mean to cut you off, but we are running on the short side of time, and we need to move on. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Kotek and Representative Greenfield.
It's always fun.
Yes.
Sheena, it's always fun.
Please.
Good to be.
Would it be possible to have the
you've got maximum of 4 minutes now. Are you going to duplicate each other's comments? In which case, I don't need to have all of the duplications.
We won't.
Good morning, Representative Chair Jensen and members of the committee. My name is Brent Foster. I'm here, I'm the executive director for Columbia Riverkeeper, Sierra Club Executive Committee. The fluoridation issue in the last year has fundamentally changed, and in a number of important ways. As I think most of you are aware, there is currently an infant formula warning that says, do not feed, do not use fluoridated tablets.
Heard that, please.
The problem of it is, and this is a letter from Oregon Action, which works on low-income, minority issues, healthcare issues in North and Northeast Portland. What their letter points out is if fluoridation becomes the law of the state, low-income kids who are already born with several strikes against them will now have to deal with fluorosis. Dentists and some of the promoters dismiss fluorosis. It's merely cosmetic. It's a $15,000 to $30,000 cosmetic effect for kids who can't afford to fix it. It's a real effect. And I think it honestly raises real equal protection issues about what our water supply is going to do. If it's going to adversely affect low-income kids, sure, rich kids can buy bottled water. Like the ADA representatives have proposed, low-income kids can't. Secondly, National Research Council, National Academy of Science report laid out pretty clearly that there are significant questions. For 20 years, we thought 4 parts per million was the safe maximum contaminant level. That just changed. There are real questions that don't support pushing fluoridation at this time, not the least of which is the Harvard bone cancer study. 500% increased risk of bone cancer, published by Harvard's Cancer Journal, funded by the National Institute of Health. Is it the end of the question? No, it's certainly not. But we pulled Vioxx from the shelf, and 20,000 lawsuits were filed when we found a 200% increased risk of bone cancer. Thank you.
Mr. Chair. Just
to be
clear, is that the study that you quoted on the bone cancer, the master's thesis, in which the major professor included a note saying that they they were unable to reproduce it?
What two things? It was the published study by Elizabeth Bassin. In the publication that released that report, the editor, which at that time was under investigation for falsifying reports to the National Institute of Health, which said this report found that there was no association between bone cancer and fluoride, he did say that the reports, he had not been able to, he has some other studies. He did not say that they were unable to be reproduced, which is different. What he said is, I have this different data set, it may show something different, that's yet to be published, it's yet to be peer-reviewed, and there's no, right now, the best science out there is the Harvard Bassin study.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Martha Pellegrino, representing the city of Portland. I'd like to just briefly start off by saying that I'm not weighing in today on whether fluoride is a good or a bad thing. I would like to address the local control issue and the election issue, though. But first, I'd like to extend thanks to Representative Greenlick, Representative Kotek, for being cognizant of that issue. And I think that these, we just saw these Dash 5 amendments, so I haven't really had an opportunity to review them very closely. But I do want to sort of note that there's a letter from the City of Portland, potentially in your packets or in your folders on this issue, that explains some concerns. One of them, and Portland is in a unique situation, we are the wholesale water providers to 27 communities and districts, and I know that Amanda Rich is here from Special Districts, so she may have be able to elaborate. But as a wholesale provider, we have 5, 10, and 20-year contracts with these water agencies. The way, and again, I saw a previous version of amendments, but for example, if the City of Portland were to have a vote as allowed in these amendments, and the City of Tigard, for example, who receives our water, also has a vote, and the City of Portland votes to fluoridate and the City of Tigard votes it down, there's really not an option for the voters of Tigard. And so I'm concerned that that is an unintended consequence that may be coming out of this, and that situation could be replicated up to 27 times with members. The other thing it does is call into question the contract that we have with these organizations. So on that issue, I'd be happy to work with members to try to figure out how we can avoid an issue or a situation where voters are disenfranchised under this amendment. A second quick point is that I want to respond to Senator Bates' question. The issue of fluoridation has come before the voters of Portland 4 times. And one time the voters voted for it as a charter amendment and then repealed that charter amendment 2 years later. Since then, there has not been any activity on that, although I do believe that there is sympathy for addressing the issue. And there's 3 different ways that it can get on the ballot in Portland. One of them would just be for folks to collect signatures like they would in the state process. So I will leave it at that, and I appreciate your time this morning.
Do you have a quick comment?
Just very quickly, my name is Margie Hoffman. For the record, I represent the Oregon Dental Association, and I think I can speak on behalf of the public health community in Oregon. I've worked with a lot of you personally on this issue. I appreciate you taking up this very, very complicated issue, but dental caries are up 10% in Oregon than they were last year. It is a huge problem in our state. It leads to systemic diseases. So I very, very much appreciate all of the time and effort that you as legislators have put into this very important issue.
Oh, come on.
It's true. We have a call to the House.
Can we just vote quickly?
We will.
We're going to lose the senator pretty quick, too. We're probably getting ready to go into session right now, I imagine.
We will.
Just on the work session.
Stand in recess here for
3 or 4 minutes. I'll literally table the work session to August 1st.
Senator, your motion is out of order since I'd already put us in recess for 4 or 5 minutes.
There we go.
We will be back in session, and we'll try to. We are adjourned.